and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the suspended head of Cambridge Analytica refusing to appear at a UK parliamentary inquiry into the misuse of data on 87 million Facebook users in the 2016 election, which helped elect Donald Trump. And speak with Jamie Bartlett, Director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos, who presented the two-part BBC documentary series The Secrets of Silicon Valley and is the author of the new book The People vs. Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. He joins us to discuss the struggle between dataism and humanism and the fight against algorithmic authoritarianism as the titans of Silicon Valley see their future markets in authoritarian states like China and are willing to export their business model of surveillance capitalism to work alongside police state censorship and surveillance of Chinese citizens who use their platforms. We'll explore what can be done to save democracy from big data and revive humanism to wean users from their zombie-like addiction to their devices. Then we'll examine the explosion of outrage in India over the latest rapes and murders of an 8-year-old girl and of a teenage girl raped over several days by a legislator and his brother who belonged to Prime Minister Modi's ruling BJP party. Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University and is the author of Ascending India and Its State Capacity, joins us to discuss how Modi's Hindu fundamentalism and patriarchal outlook appear to render him tone-deaf to the plight of poor young women and girls from minority communities who are frequent targets of BJP nationalists. Then finally, we'll get an update on the fallout following the recent American, French, and British bombing of Syria, which is widely seen as a futile and militarily insignificant gesture, which will not impede the Assad regime from committing its daily acts of brutal depravity against the Syrian people. Henri Barkey, Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University, who served on the State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss his article at The National, Limited Strikes, Limited Goals, and No Strategy on Syria, and the state of chaos in Washington, where one day the U.S. representative to the UN announces sanctions against Russia, then the next day Trump reverses her and gives Putin a free pass yet again. And joining us now from the UK is Jamie Bartlett, the Director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos and the best-selling author of The Dark Net, an examination of the hidden corners of the Internet and radicals, outsiders changing the world. He also writes on technology for The Spectator, and in 2017 he presented the two-part BBC documentary series The Secrets of Silicon Valley, and his latest book is The People vs. Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Bartlett.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That's quite a long profile I've got building up now, isn't it, over the years?
It is. Well, presumably you deserve it. So let's use your expertise. Now, obviously today in the UK, the suspended head of Cambridge Analytica refused to appear before the UK Parliamentary Committee on Digital Culture, Media and Sports. So what do you make of Alexander Nix's refusal and whether there are civil and criminal penalties that he may be exposed to under the Data Protection Act?
Well, I only just heard this and I was actually very disappointed. There's a coterie of us here in the UK especially who were really getting the popcorn out, excited to watch him being grilled, remember, for the second time, because he was actually recalled to the committee after his first appearance because the chair and other members felt like there were a number of inconsistencies in his account and others. Now, his claim is that he's pulled out because of ongoing legal considerations. The chair, Damian Collins, has said that does not bar him from appearing in front of the committee, and he will be expecting him to appear at a future date. My understanding is that he's not legally obliged to appear, so he won't be fined or any other sanction for not appearing. But that generally speaking, people think that once you're asked, you really should appear. And so we'll see. We'll see. My speculation would be that the intensity, the media scrutiny, today Brittany Kaiser, one of his former colleagues, gave evidence. I imagine he's just trying to almost work out the new information that's come to light and what his responses will be. So maybe he's kind of playing for a bit more time.
So yesterday I interviewed the author of a new book about democracy versus capitalism, and in the sense that capitalism in many ways is more compatible, or appears to be more compatible, with authoritarian regimes and kleptocracies like the one we have in China, Russia, Turkey, and the Philippines. And preserving and defending democracy, which is in retreat around the world, is a job that requires more effort. And another dimension, of course, is your book, People versus Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy. And there's also the historian Noah Yuval Harari talks about the struggle between dataism and humanism. So we've got quite a lot to bite off there. But let's start with why you feel the internet is killing democracy.
Yeah, the reason I think all of these books are coming out at the moment is because we're grappling with the idea that democracy is not quite as stable as we once thought and seems to be under threat in all sorts of different places. It's in retreat in some places. It's not getting better in other places. And we're wondering why. My argument is that, to put it as simply as possible, I suppose, it's not that all forms of democracy are incompatible with all forms of digital technology. It's that the current system of democracy we have, a representative mass party system, which really sort of that's grounded in the nation state and principles of rule of law, is relatively old. It's a couple of hundred years old for representative democracy and 100 years old or so for mass party democracy, and hasn't really evolved or changed much in the last century. So it's built to a particular set of technologies, and along comes another one, digital tech, which is borderless in many respects, very hard to control. It's often quite decentralized. It's improving at a dramatic pace, and the two are in tension. They don't really work very well, very easily together. And so my suggestion is that all the institutions that we've built up to make democracy work in a modern context, relatively large and strong middle class, free and fair press, free and fair election, that people can trust, informed citizens with a shared sense of reality and a willingness to sort of try to compromise with each other, all of those things are being slowly, I'm not saying dramatically and immediately, but slowly eroded by this new technology.
And how much do you think the titans of Silicon Valley, like the libertarian Peter Thiel, who spoke at the Republican convention and was spent the election night with Donald Trump along with the plutocrat Koch brother, you know, he's got the Seasteading Institute, and also Zuckerberg seems to be willing to work with the Chinese government, and also Apple, of course, agreed to store iCloud keys in China, which would expose iPhone users in China to the Chinese intelligence surveillance. So given that, is this trend being driven by the titans themselves, or is it happening independently of them?
Yes, it's a good question. I think a lot of people in Silicon Valley, Peter Thiel may be one of the exceptions, because he has himself said that politics and technology are essentially in a state of war with each other, or a race. I think that many of the titans of Silicon Valley would consider themselves to be Democrats. They do believe in the ideas of representative democracy. They genuinely believe that their technology would help that, by giving people more ideas, more information, more connection, so on. And yet they have almost inadvertently built technology which in many ways undermines it, i.e. they didn't really mean it to turn out this way. But they're locked into these big companies. And remember, of course, that a lot of them, Facebook being the obvious example, started off not really as a private profit-making company at all, but a sort of a relatively harmless way of people to share bits and pieces about themselves. And yet suddenly in Silicon Valley, what happens is you you get a load of VC investment and you're tied into all sorts of growth profit quarterlies and profit targets and so on, and suddenly you become a slightly different beast. So, but generally speaking, I think it's not something of their design. They don't intend it to undermine democracy, but because they are so incredibly optimistic, naively so, about the powers of data and connectivity, so I think many of them are surprised that so many bad things seem to be happening on their platform. I mean, I think it's fairly obvious, of course, but they seem not to believe that. So generally, I would say, no, it's more the tech than the people, but you do, of course, have, I think the general libertarian outlook in Silicon Valley means they will tend to value individual liberty over the ability of governments to act. And the truth about democracy is it is a system that does require strong governments who can act.
And again, I'm speaking with Jamie Bartlett, who is in the UK. He's the director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos and the best-selling author of The Dark Net, an examination of the hidden corners of the internet and radicals, outsiders changing the world. He also writes on technology for The Spectator. And in 2017, he presented the two-part BBC documentary series, The Secrets of Silicon Valley. And his latest book is The People Versus Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. And at Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park, there's a big poster saying the next billion. And that seems to be where their new customers are. The appeal seems to be waning in the West and amongst the advanced countries. Of course, China is a huge potential for them, India as well. So what's your sense of what Zeynep Tufekci is talking about in a TED talk, algorithmic authoritarianism? How is that distinct or distinguished from the basic business model that both Google and Facebook have, which is referred to as surveillance capitalism?
Well, it's not necessarily. I mean, I think what Zeynep and others are suggesting is that it actually goes fairly well together. And maybe it goes back to one of those previous books you mentioned, that certain forms of capitalism are, in fact, work far better in authoritarian regimes, because the power of modern technology, the way that algorithms are increasingly getting so powerful that it gives a kind of predictive edge to whoever controls that technology, i.e. is getting easier for whoever runs and owns the technology to predict what people will do, will buy, will say, will think, will spend their time with. This gives an incredible amount of power to authoritarians if they can get hold of this technology, because it gives them unprecedented surveillance potential. So to me, in countries like China, the prospects for democracy in the years ahead are actually extremely dim, and I'm not wholly optimistic. What worries me is that in Western democracies, we will slowly fall under the charms of trusting algorithms or giving governments more and more power over algorithms, simply in a quest to maintain some degree of order in society. So it's not just a threat, this idea of sort of algorithmic authoritarianism. It's not just a threat to the obvious bad guys. It's a threat, I think, to all of us. And surveillance capitalism, the idea that a big part of modern capitalism is in fact based on looking at what you are doing at all times in order to better sell adverts to you or understand you, to sell you products based on building up profiles of you, is of course central to the idea of algorithmic authoritarianism, because algorithms need data, they need profiles, they need to understand people if they're able to predict what they do. So the two are inextricably linked.
And of course, Facebook extracts extraordinary revenues per user, $84 in North America and $27 in Europe in 2017. So do you think there's a wake-up given the Cambridge Analytica revelations about 87 million Facebook users' data being used to help, essentially to help elect Donald Trump? A lot of people in this country don't like Donald Trump. More people voted against him. So do you think there's a wake-up going on, possibly? I know there's a movement to delete Facebook.
Yeah, it's hard to know. But to me, I've it feels even bigger somehow than the Edward Snowden revelations of 2012? I can't remember now. It feels like there has been more media coverage, there's been more concern, there's been more interest from not just members of the public, but from politicians as well, saying this cannot go on. We need to do something. You got that sense from Mark Zuckerberg's recent evidence that he gave to the Senate and congressional committees that the politicians were sharking around, sort of ready and thinking about more regulation. So it feels like there's been something of a wake-up call from both people and politicians. But we honestly, it's too early to say, because we've had moments a bit like this in the past where people are outraged. They say they're going to delete Facebook. They say they're going to use encrypted messaging instead. And yet they end up, in the end, returning to the platform because it's so good and so convenient. So it's to be seen. There's definitely more public awareness about it. Whether that translates into action, I really hesitate to predict.
So turning from the political to, I guess, the sociological, for the want of a better description, I mentioned the historian Noah Yuval Harari's talking about the struggle between dataism and humanism. What do you think is going to reverse that tide? I mean, when you go to a restaurant and you in anywhere you go, you see people sitting at tables not looking at each other, not talking to each other, but looking at their palms. And, of course, you know, there's the famous paintings here by Norman Rockwell of the halcyon days of the American dream, of the family sitting around the dinner table or the Thanksgiving dinner table, all engaged. It is troubling, and you see particularly young people staring in their palms all the time, almost as if this little instrument is fulfilling a kind of loneliness.
Yeah. What do I think will, or what do I think should?
Yes,
because
both.
They're potentially different. I mean, there's things I think we should do to try to stop this, but whether they will is, I suppose, a different question. I mean, I have suggested in my book that, yes, we're going to need more, certainly more regulation on data ownership, data rights for citizens, limitations on data sharing, simply to try to stop the ever-growing power of algorithms in our lives. And similarly, governments should have the right to do spot checks on private companies' algorithms to make sure that they're not being misused or being discriminatory. And I think one of the big things you might find in the next 12 months is governments considering regulation of whether these technology devices are actually addictive. Have they been designed to be as addictive as possible? And when you see, as you say, hordes of young zombies walking around the streets staring down at their phones rather than up in front of them, you see that they are addiction machines in many respects. And we regulate other forms of addiction. And so we may even see fairly soon that the government start to say we need to regulate the way that these platforms are designed to not be addictive. But in the end as well, I think it's going to take something of a bit of a revolt and a revolution among us citizens, us users, that we cultivate our sense of independence of mind, that we try to have more switch-off times, that we try to avoid getting into the cycle of checking things every 10 minutes. Because we are doing this. We are building these technologies, and we are allowing ourselves to become addicted. I hope things like the recent Cambridge Analytica story has shown quite where that can take us, and we will respond, but let's see.
And could you add to that the revelations about Russia's meddling in both the US elections and in Brexit there in the UK? Is that a wake-up call that's being heard?
A lot of people are worried about our democracy being tampered with, meddled with. And once you start talking about democracies, people get very nervous and worried, so they want to do something about it. I mean, I think it's been fairly well established now that the Russian aspiration here was not simply to change the results of the election, but more likely to sow discord and disharmony among citizens. And I think on that, you can say they've actually been pretty successful. So again, it's very early days to see, but I certainly have a sense there is a building momentum here for something to be done.
Well, I thank you for joining us. And I take it that's why you wrote The People versus Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. And the second part, how we save it, is the key, right?
The key is also acting before it's too late. So it's easy to sit here and think, oh, things aren't that bad. But we drift slowly and gradually into having our freedoms eroded. And so it's important that we act now rather than wait until it gets too late to respond.
Well, Jamie Butler, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamie Bartlett, who's in the UK. He's the director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos, and the best-selling author of The Dark Net, An Examination of the Hidden Corners of the Internet and Radicals Outsiders Changing the World. He also writes on technology for The Spectator, and in 2017 he presented the two-part BBC documentary series The Secrets of Silicon Valley, and his latest book is The People versus Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the explosion of outrage in India over the latest rapes and murders of an 8-year-old girl and a teenage girl.
It's a very dangerous thing to do exactly what you want because you cannot know yourself or what you really do with all your power. With all your
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Culture and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book is Ascending India and Its State's Capacity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you for joining us, Sumit. And the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, got blasted by the editorial board of the New York Times in their lead editorial in Tuesday's New York Times over his apparent indifference to the victims of rape in India and this kind of a culture of rape that we've heard about for some time. So what's going on there? I mean, there have been some pretty horrible incidents involving the rape and murder of an 8-year-old girl in January. And apparently the perpetrators, there's a cover-up going on in the state government of the Uttar Pradesh estate, which is governed by the BJP, Modi's party.
Yes, just a small clarification. There were two rapes, one in the state of Uttar Pradesh and the other in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And the 8-year-old girl was abducted, raped, and killed in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And in both cases, there were attempts to suppress the evidence and to hound the families of those in question, particularly in the case of UP. But both of these incidents are simply, in one word, horrific. I mean, a rape is a terrifying episode to begin with, but how could grown men and multiple grown men participate in the rape of an 8-year-old child simply boggles the imagination. This is simply breathtaking. It is beyond belief. What is going on, however, is that there are at least three different issues involved. First, I think our awareness of these incidents has become much greater, much better, because of better reporting on the part of Indian newspapers and the websites and the like. Secondly, social media is playing a much greater role than ever before. All one has to do is to look, turn to one's Facebook page, and if one has Indian friends or Indian colleagues, it's literally all over the pages of Facebook. And then, of course, you know, I don't follow things like Instagram and various other social network mechanisms, but it's literally all over the place. So I think our awareness is much greater. And thirdly, for the first time, these issues are being taken much more seriously in the public arena, and instead of simply being swept aside. Considering that both of these poor, unfortunate women came from sort of lower middle class or lower class families, this also shows that there is a greater awareness and a greater concern for people less fortunate. In the past, these things would be simply shrugged off. So while there is no gainsaying the horror and the disgust that one feels at these incidents, it is also a sign that there is a much greater knowledge and much greater attention that's been focused on these tragic incidents. Not to in any way suggest that these are of not of enormous significance.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds a Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Culture and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. And we're talking about the lead editorial in today's New York Times condemning the Indian Prime Minister Modi's long silence about women being raped. And of course, back in 2012, there was a gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old student on a bus in India's capital that certainly got a lot of attention. So Modi's been extremely slow in recognizing this problem, has he not? So is it too little too late for him?
It's absolutely too little too late for him. His silence on this subject was simply deafening. For all the shortcomings of the previous government, and they were legion, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh responded with considerable alacrity, condemned the incident, hung his head in shame at the appalling incident of the murder and rape of the 23-year-old that took place under his watch. And his government, I suspect, even paid a price at the polls in 2014 because of a public perception of the inability of the state to provide security for the most vulnerable. But the deafening silence of this government until when pressed on the subject is truly deplorable, in my judgment. And it is indeed shocking that it took the Prime Minister as long as it did to publicly comment on this absolutely reprehensible incident.
So Modi's a fairly odd character, from what I understand. I recall reading that he had his name embroidered on his pinstripe suits. At the same time, he kind of puts forth a public image of living an extremely austere and very deeply religious life. I don't know whether he's a lifelong celibate, but he's certainly a celibate. I don't know whether he's ever had a relationship with a woman. Is that in any way contributing to his insensitivity towards women?
No, I just think that he does not see this as a pressing issue until it's, you know, unless it's emblazoned across the headlines. It's hard to tell if the Prime Minister has any empathy for women. He did promulgate a new policy shortly after taking office which suggested the slogan for which was "Save your daughters, educate your daughters," which, of course, many of us, including myself, lauded, because what could be more laudatory than in a country like India, where women and female children face routine discrimination, to see the government inaugurate a policy which was designed to promote the education of female children and to protect women. But that's remained mostly in the realm of rhetoric. In terms of actual policy, very little has been done. And his lack of empathy, I find rather shocking. And I'm not entirely certain what this lack of empathy stems from, because he certainly talked a good line shortly after assuming office, but has not demonstrated that in terms of either his rhetoric, his policies, or actions and choices.
Well, isn't there a sort of patriarchal Hinduism inherent in the BJP's outlook? Give us a sense of how much it's tied to Hindu fundamentalism. You know, the Republican Party here in the United States, to some extent, is tied to Christian fundamentalism. The evangelicals are probably the most important component of the Republican Party. That's why Trump had to put Mike Pence on the ticket as his vice president. In using that as a yardstick, America as an example, where would you place fundamentalism in terms of Modi's leadership?
Well, India is a deeply hierarchical society, and that hierarchy affects social classes. It affects everyday relations amongst people, and the status of women in India leaves much to be desired. And Hindu zealots, Hindu fanatics, on the one hand, claim that they revere and sort of see women as goddesses, but certainly in terms of their practices and in terms of their everyday lives, they certainly treat these goddesses with considerable disdain. Like most sort of orthodox faiths, or the orthodoxy of most faiths, women are not seen as equals, even though there is a tendency to put them on a pedestal and to, and there's a kind of a mid-Victorian attitude of, you know, women who must be protected, women must be sequestered, women are sort of the weaker vessels. It's an oddly Victorian attitude towards women that permeates the thinking of much of these Hindu fanatics. And that could well explain Modi's lack of sensitivity. In principle, talking about this idea or this idealized notion of Indian women as almost amounting to goddesses, but in terms of actual behavior, seeing them largely as secondary to men. And this is, of course, reinforced by the fact that cultural norms in India, for the most part, are deeply patriarchal. And this patriarchy is deeply embedded in Indian social and political life. This doesn't mean that individual women and particular women have not been successful. And they have largely been successful because they came from the appropriate social class and thereby managed to get higher education and thereby managed to break certain ceilings. But we cannot generalize from that very small sample who have been extremely successful and have broken extraordinary barriers, some of which have not even been breached in the United States.
Well, certainly India's had female prime ministers. We haven't had a female president yet. So,
right.
So I suppose that's often used as a way to sort of suggest that things aren't as bad as they are. Is that...
No, I think that's just a way of deflecting criticism. Mm-hmm. That's a very dexterous sleight of hand. One should not denigrate the achievements of particular Indian women, but one should not also generalize from their successes. Well, one must see those for what they are. They are successes. They do represent a significant breakthroughs, but that does not mean that the overall plight of Indian women, particularly women from the poorer sections of Indian society, are in a particularly happy position.
Well, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for calling me in the first place.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London, and his books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book is Ascending India and Its State's Capacity. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an update on the fallout following the recent American, French, and British bombing of Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and a Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller. And his latest article at The National is Limited Strikes, Limited Goals, and No Strategy on Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And I must say, having the UN rep, Nikki Haley, say that we're locked and loaded if Assad tries to use chemical weapons again really rang hollow, in the sense that we're basically saying it's okay to use barrel bombs, starvation, you name it, kill your own people in droves, but just don't use chemical weapons. It seems to sort of display the complete bankruptcy of our policy. But hasn't that been the case all along, that the Russians and the Iranians have known what they want, and so has Assad, but the West, and in particular the U.S., have never known what they wanted out of the Syria situation. They've known what they don't want, but not what they want. And it's always been a mess, hasn't it?
Yes. But that said, look, it was very clear from the beginning that the United States was not going to get involved in a land war against the regime, especially after what happened in Iraq. I mean, President Obama was very clear about this. He tried to avoid any which way he could to get involved in Syria, including not sending bombers when Assad used weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, back in 2013. So I think at this stage to say that the United States and the allies are allowing Assad and his henchmen and his allies to kill as many people as they want without chemical weapons, it's true, but it's also unfair. We need to ask ourselves the question, do we want the United States to go into a land war? Because that's the only way that a regime change can take place. And what was doable maybe 5 years ago or 6 years ago is no longer doable now. It's because you have large numbers of Russians and Iranian troops there. So we need to be, in that sense, a little bit realistic about what is possible and what is not possible.
So what's your sense then of whether, I mean, when you talk about, you know, not being ready for a ground war, just recently the 2,000 special forces that seem to be in a very key location, they occupy Assad's oil fields, which he obviously wants. They seem to be astride a potential land route between Tehran and Damascus. And, of course, Trump was about to basically pull them out recently. But they were attacked by the Syrian Fifth Corps, including a group of Russian mercenaries. And the air power that the U.S. has really was pretty devastating. So, obviously, it's too late to do anything. But it does seem that there is still American power there, and Trump is about to give up a chip in return for nothing. It seems like maybe he's been re-educated on that. What can the U.S. use this leverage to gain?
Look, the 2,000 American troops are in northeastern Syria, and they're allied with Syrian Kurds there. So they're not there alone. Yes, you're making reference to an event a few months ago when American troops and their allies came under fire from Syrians and mercenaries and Russian mercenaries, and the United States responded very strongly. But that was a one-off thing. To change the regime in Damascus, you need to occupy Damascus. This is different than having a military action in northeastern Syria where there is no really serious regime presence. And you're there with the Syrian Kurds who are essentially of the region. So that's when, if you were to go into Damascus, you have a civilian population. Look, I'm not saying we should give up on the idea that Assad should go. I mean, it sounds to me as if everybody has come to the realization that he is going to be there for a while. There's not much we can do. We might as well live with it. I mean, that's certainly a realistic analysis, but I will submit to you that if the United States, together with its Gulf allies, with the Europeans, were to come up, maybe could come up. I'm not saying it's possible, but we need to rethink this whole strategy towards Assad and Syria. Maybe there is an alternative that is in between overthrow and Assad staying in power. Maybe there's a way we can cut a deal with the Iranians, with the Russians, once we have the Gulf allies and other countries, maybe the Indians, the Pakistanis, you know, other countries together, having broad coalition to negotiate and to talk to the Russians and the Iranians. I'm not saying this is possible, but it's certainly worth a try. But for that, you have to have a State Department that functions here. You need to have a National Security Council that wants to push for this. And at the moment, as you pointed out, you know, President Trump one day says one thing, another day does exactly the opposite, and we never really know exactly what it is that he's thinking. I mean, his tweet two weeks ago that he wanted to pull out all the American troops out of Syria was terribly, terribly ill-advised. Why he did it, we still do not know to this day, right? And pulling out the American troops without having accomplished the job, which is to completely eradicate ISIS, and to also leave the allies that the United States fought with, the Syrian Kurds, alone to face a whole series of enemies after they sacrificed so many of their own to do our bidding. So it's terribly badly thought. And in fact, the Pentagon came back and pushed him on this. But apparently, the White House is still maintaining this position that it wants to pull those troops out, because President Macron yesterday, in a very long interview with French television, said that he had convinced President Trump to stay the course in Syria, and we find out today that the White House pushed back and said, no, we still want to pull the troops out. So you have complete chaos at the moment at the White House, and this is not the way to run policy. It's okay to do strikes on the chemical facilities, but as I've argued, you know, this is a very limited political strike. It's not military. It was designed to send a message to Assad about chemical weapons and chemical weapons only. But you still need a broader strategy. I mean, just to have a one-off action in the middle of chaos really doesn't make that much sense.
Well, the earlier remark of pulling out in a rally in Ohio that the president made, and then subsequent, as you just mentioned, to Macron's interview on French television, the pushback from the White House, could be categorized as strategic malpractice because, again, you give up a chip and you get nothing in return. What kind of position can the U.S. play in terms of an end game here? My sense is that there might be some daylight between the Russians and the Iranians. I believe the Russians are very frustrated with Assad because he won't negotiate, whereas Iranians are quite ruthless and may well have been behind about this latest gas attack. Obviously, there's no State Department, and we don't have a Secretary of State, and we have a hawk as a National Security Advisor. But what kind of strategy could the U.S. play if we had better leadership?
No, look, with the American troops in eastern Syria, I mean, in some ways, I understand why any administration would like to get them out, because it's only 2,000 people. You don't want them to stay there for a long time because they're exposed. You don't know much what may happen tomorrow, etc. Okay, but we have them there. They are an important component because they control about 20%, maybe 25% of Syrian territory with the Syrian Kurds and the Syrian Democratic Forces. And they are, as you said, a chip. That is to say, they're a chip in terms of the future disposition of Syria. If the United States is at the table, more powerfully, so to say, with those troops than with and without the troops, because it has something to bargain, right? It has something to bargain with the Turks, with the Russians, with the Iranians. Now, you have to also look at it from the Russian perspective. I mean, the Russians are in this because they want to show that the United States cannot push everybody around like it used to. Two, it's for the Russians, Syria is important, has always been important, because it is their entry card into the Middle East, and especially into the Mediterranean. I think the Russians just concluded a 49-year deal with the Syrian regime over the lease of one of the naval bases on the Mediterranean. That gives them a lot of an important role, I should say, in the Mediterranean. They're not about to give this up. Putin wants to play big on the international scene, and Syria, to some extent, has been the way or the card he has used to go back into, should I say, international politics in a major way. So there may be daylight, or there may not be daylight between the Iranians and the Russians, but I don't know that for a fact. But what I can say is that the Russians are going to be very hard to negotiate with. What you need to convince the Russians that in the long run that they can still have a role in Syria, but backing Assad is going to be a very expensive proposition, because they're not going to be able to win decisively against the insurgency. This insurgency is going to last for some time to come. And at some point, the Russians may also with casualties.
Well, isn't there another wild card, Henri Barkey, and that is Israel's concern about Iran's growing influence? You mentioned in your article at the National Limited Strikes, Limited Goals and No Strategy on Syria that the U.S. 2,000 troops there are preventing the completion of the materially unimportant but symbolically crucial Tehran-Baghdad-Damascus-Beirut highway or land bridge that would signify a regional victory for Iran. My understanding is that the Israelis don't want that to succeed, and they don't want these Arab Shia militias from Iraq that are being trained as Iranian proxies to come into Syria.
Well, that's true, but Nobody wants that language. I mean, when I say the language is materially unimportant but psychologically important, I mean the Iranians don't need a language to bring arms to Hezbollah. I mean, they've been doing it for years. There are many other ways. You can fly. You can send ships. So the language is a psychological factor that, especially for the Saudis and other Gulf countries, it would be seen as a major victory for the Iranians, and that the Iranians will be able to throw more of their weight around if they succeed, essentially, in having that language. Again, psychologically, not materially. So, yes, that's why I think the United States can keep the troops in eastern Syria for the time being, use them as a lever, and use that as to get a better bargaining position at the table, but also get the Gulf countries with you and come up with a strategy. Look, Syria has been very complex with all these peace negotiations, whether it is Astana process or the Geneva process. Secretary of Defense Mattis clearly says he prefers the Geneva process, which is international, where the other one is Russians and Turks and Iranians. But you have to come up with some big comprehensive solution. So you have to work on it. But at the moment, I don't think the Americans and the Gulf countries are agreed on any specific policy or strategy.
Well,
we don't know at the moment whether the White House has made its peace with Assad winning. Maybe it has, maybe it hasn't. I mean, certainly Trump implies that he has made his peace, but the rest of the bureaucracy doesn't seem to have come to that conclusion, and there is a great deal of resistance to that idea in the American public. So we don't know where we are.
Well, but surely things could get worse. You've got something over 1 million Syrian refugees along the Jordanian border. You've got, I think, more in Turkey. You've got the possibility of another siege of Idlib province and refugees, Sunni Arabs, pouring into Turkey and perhaps even on into Europe again, which happened when the Russians first came in. So there's an awful lot more mischief or mayhem, I think is a better way to put it, that Assad could exercise. So what is the position of the Turks and the Jordanians in terms of what are you going to do with all those millions of people?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, look, the thing we seem to forget about all this is that Assad has no intention of taking back these refugees. There are 3 million refugees in Turkey alone. As you said, up to 1 million on the Jordanian side of the border. Many more in Iraq and in Kurdistan, right? Europe. And you can go on and on. Oh, this, not to mention Lebanon. I mean, Lebanese have no say in this matter, although they are the country that is most affected and most involved in this. They're involved because Hezbollah is doing the fighting for Assad. And the estimates are 1 in 4 Lebanese is actually Syrian, a refugee from Syria. And Assad doesn't want them back because most of these refugees are people that are unhappy with Assad and are potential dissenters. That's why I take them back. Let other countries worry about it. That fact in of itself should be a very powerful incentive to come up with a solution, because otherwise all these refugees are going to be staying where they are. Or what will happen is what the Turks are doing now. The Turks invaded Syrian Kurdish territory, kicked out all the Syrian Kurdish population, and now are trying to push some of the Syrian refugees who are in Syria, in Turkey, into this area called Afrin, which is not, which is a Syrian Kurdish territory. But you're creating another problem that you're going to create that will, you know, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, will become another flashpoint for violence. So it is in the, there are plenty of incentives as to why people should say enough is enough after 7 years of civil war, that we have to come up with a solution. But for that, you need some committed leadership. And I'm sorry, I don't see it coming from the United States, and I don't see it coming from anybody else at the moment, which is why we have all these different efforts, Geneva and Astana, and none of them will ultimately produce anything. Because, first of all, Assad feels no pressure at the moment, absolutely none, which is why, in some ways, he did what he did in terms of using chemical weapons. And he, there's no pressure on him. I mean, the truth is, he's been using chemical weapons, but he hasn't produced large numbers of casualties and therefore did not attract the world's attention. This time, there was something happened and lots of people died and suddenly the world woke up. But in reality, Assad is doing whatever he wants to do and there are no constraints on him. So you have to change that calculation. You have to figure out a way of putting pressure on Assad, because the Iranians and the Russians are not going to do it. And so if they don't do it, who's going to do it? Why should he change his policies when he thinks he's doing very well, thank you?
And this is rather symbolic and rather cosmetic use of 105 cruise missiles on buildings that I think were largely empty certainly doesn't seem to have impressed him.
No, the one thing I would add is this particular raid was a political message. Right? Part of when you look at what Macron said that night, is he crossed the red line and we hit him. And the implication is, you do it again, we'll do it again. But since now we've hit the chemical weapons production facilities, right, we may go for something else. And that is essentially the threat on Assad at the moment. And that's the only threat we have.
Well, Ori Barkey, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ori Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and a senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller. And his latest article at The National is Limited Strikes, Limited Goals, and No Strategy on Syria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time, one night.